All right. We're going to be back into an informational meeting, and I'd like to welcome at this time Keith Levitt, Manager of State Government Relations, Port of Portland, giving us an overview of port operations.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair. For the record, I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland, and I will give you an overview. I've got a few handouts for the committee that I'll allude to, but I'll try to make my comments. I know both of you have a pretty good understanding of what we do. The Port of Portland is a cross between state government, local government, and private sector. All of our authority comes from state statute. We do have a tax base in the metro region, which is the Tri-County area. Equates to about 2 to 4% of our operating revenue. All the rest of our budget operating revenue comes from the private sector activities that we engage in, and that's really directed towards fulfilling our mission, which is to provide transportation access to regional, national, and international markets for both people and freight in this state and in the region. In fulfilling that mission, we own and operate Portland International Airport and 3 general aviation airports in the metropolitan area. Just quickly, I'll highlight a few key issues that we're seeing on the air side of our operations. Out of PDX, the number one, we've seen an incredible decade of growth over the 90s. We've also, as you know, we're coming close to reconstructing an airport out there while trying to operate an airport at the same time, and we've come a long way in our construction activities. The number one area of growth for the airport right now is air freight, and that is driven largely from the high-tech sector, the growth of the high-tech economy in this state, and then the high-value commodities and products that those companies are producing, and the fact that they don't weigh very much. You can put them in the belly of aircraft, even in passenger aircraft, but we also have several air carriers just for freight. And so we've seen a real big increase, and we project a tripling of air freight cargo through the port over the next 20 years. So that's a real area of emphasis. Part of that is the trend towards e-commerce, towards business productivity that has allowed just-in-time delivery and turnaround of producing a product, getting it to market in as efficient of time frame as possible. And so that part of what we see as a trend, clearly still the number one mode of transportation for moving freight around the region is truck. And with e-commerce and with the communications and the technology that has increased over the last several years, it has caused more truck traffic, not less, and more of a need for us to be concerned about freight mobility and where the choke points are for moving products, where they're beginning and where they're terminating. So on the aviation side, in a nutshell, as a real summary, those are the key issues that we're looking at. I guess one other issue I'll mention is direct service to Asia is a big issue. As you know, we had Delta that provided daily nonstop service to Asia, and they are pulling out as of May of this year. And so we are trying to find another air carrier to come in and serve this market directly. We have an Asian, we have significant Asian investment in our state, in our region. We do a lot of direct business there. We want to be an international state. We want to be an international community. And having direct air service is important to do. So we're busy trying to market our resources and our facilities to other air carriers. Moving on to marine, real quick, I just wanted the context to view our marine facilities is really within the Columbia Snake River system context. The Port of Portland is the hub, if you will, of a river system that extends 465 miles inland all the way to Lewiston, Idaho. The first 105 miles is deep draft navigation from Astoria to Portland. Currently, there is a 40-foot navigation channel, that is maintained annually by the United States Army Corps of Engineers. And as you know, we have a simple little project to increase that depth to 43 feet that we're trying to get done. And there is a proposal in front of you this session to help provide the state funding share for that project, and I'm glad to answer any questions on that. Upriver from Portland is 8 federal navigation dams and locks, providing barge transportation all the way to Lewiston. And what that provides is a cost-effective mode for our Eastern Oregon farmers and producers and manufacturing companies who locate in the rural areas of our state to have direct access to efficient transportation. Along with that is a probably the best rail system in the West Coast, definitely in the Northwest. We have both Class I railroads on each side of the Columbia River at river grade going through the Cascades, and that's what they don't have that in Washington. And that allows for unit trains to efficiently move from the Midwest to the Portland area. All of that, and we also have pretty good highway access. I-5 and I-84 provide north, south, and east-west intersections. All these modes come together in Portland, and I think through luck of geography, the Port of Portland has been able to evolve as a port because of that. Our niche in the world is agricultural exports, and number one in the country in wheat, number two in the world, Columbia River is, as a grain export center behind only the Mississippi. We also are leading exports of mineral bulks, number four in the country as a port for import and export of autos, and containers is something.
Keith, let me interrupt you. What were the mineral bulks?
The mineral bulks are two, they're the white mineral bulks, and it's potash and soda ash used for fertilizer. Potash is out of Canada, and soda ash is used to make windows, glass, and that comes out of Wyoming. And it's because of this sufficient rail system that it's able to come through here. Moving on to containers, and this is the point I really wanted to make to the committee. We are not a major player on the West Coast as far as a major container port. L.A., Long Beach, Seattle, Tacoma, much larger ports to the nation as far as containers. However, at Terminal 6, we serve a strategic interest to the region's shippers who rely on exports. And we just completed a study that I handed out to your committee that shows that if you didn't have access to Terminal 6, what would the cost be to the 1,000 or so businesses throughout Oregon and the Northwest that utilize the river to ship their containers? What would that cost be? The total amount would be about $68 million annually. And the reason I bring that up is containers, 28 out of 36 counties in Oregon have businesses that use Terminal 6 to ship their containers. It's very diverse as far as the key counties. It's the largest counties that benefit are Multnomah, Marion, Lane, and Umatilla. Then you go to Jackson, you go to Clackamas, Washington. So it's a good diverse rural-urban benefit for containerization. And I raise that because containers are the sector of shipping that absolutely must have the 43-foot channel in order to keep that those container carriers calling in Portland. And I handed to you also an article that the Oregonian ran yesterday. Our number one container carrier has now decided to leave Portland, and they're citing two things. One is channel depth, and the other is the Asian economy. The Asian economy is getting better, but we know that if we don't proceed with the channel deepening project, our ability to sustain container shipping is going to be lost, and the impact is not only a financial impact in the port's ability to operate a terminal, but really the impact is on the rates that are going to be charged to businesses throughout the state who use Portland as their shipping point. It costs about $350 to $400 to ship a container between Portland and Seattle, and they would have to pay that extra cost in order to get the product to market. If you're in a rural part of the state, that added cost is going to make it much more difficult to locate in that rural area versus locate closer to the transportation network. With that, I see you have a quorum, Mr. Chair. I'm going to stop right there. We are clearly, channel deepening is our number one issue looking forward. We're very concerned about transportation and financing of transportation and the ability to get the products actually to our facilities. And so those are kind of the two key issues as we look move forward that we're keeping a close eye on and would like to be involved with your committee as you deliberate on those issues moving forward.
Keith, keep us informed on that channel deepening, because we, even though we're not a major shipper of any kind, we've had many times have had to take containers and send them to L.A. or up to Seattle in order to get them on a ship that could not come into our port. So this is really critical because it doesn't take very long, and the competitive advantage that you might have had goes away very quickly. So hopefully we're going to be able to do something with you on that issue.
Great. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Apologize.
Senator Kleinfeld.
You know, it's a long ways from down in the LFO office to get clear back to my office and get my stuff. I knew I was going to be late, and I hope you got the message that I would be late, but I didn't expect to be this late. And sorry you had to run me down, but they've just been keeping me down there, giving me budget figures, and I've been trying to digest them. So I appreciate your patience.
Have you been watching on the camera to see us all going back and forth?
No, I have not.
This would be a tape that should end up on Signy Die, properly edited. To be correct.
I haven't. I'll have to look at it later.
Well, Keith, thank you so much. And
thank you.
I know you're going to do a good job of keeping us informed, but it is really critical to where we're headed. And we're talking about ways and means here, but also in revenue. When we look at some of our areas of industry in the state and seeing them go backwards, I mean, obviously, all of a sudden, everybody in the state pays really close attention to what's going on in our economy. And you're a critical part of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Keith.
All right. I'm going to close an informational meeting, and I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 317. Patrick, will you go ahead and read the bill? It looks like everyone's coming back in, and tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 317 requires a person to be domiciled in or a resident of the state in order to obtain an identification card from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Oregon statute does not presently require a person to be domiciled in or a resident of the state in order to obtain an identification card. In order to receive an identification card, a person must not have a current valid driver's license, must furnish evidence of their age and identity, and a verification of their address. Proponents contend that this measure will reduce the abuse of Oregon state identification cards by residents of other states. There is no revenue impact. A fiscal impact has been issued, $207,000 fiscal impact. That's a reduction in revenues in the 2001 to 2003 biennium, and a $289,000 reduction in revenues during the 2003 to 2005 biennium. Once again, this bill is anticipated by the governor's recommended budget.
Okay, is Kelly going to have this?
Yes.
Okay.
The first testifier is Kelly Taylor of ODOT.
Good afternoon, Kelly. I'm going to tell you that you are to state your name for the record, because I was just down a committee and failed to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. The department requested this bill in order to try to address concerns that were brought to us repeatedly, different examples from both financial institutions, law enforcement, retail institutions, et cetera, about the concern. And in almost all ways, except for this residency requirement, ID cards and driver's licenses, the requirements are very similar. The legislature through the years has required an ID card to use the same security features and things like that. I mean, they've been bolstering the ID card all along. But one thing that's not been on the books is the fact that, or is the requirement, that in order to receive an Oregon ID card, you be a resident of Oregon or domiciled here. And domiciled means your place of abode is here, and that you intend to remain here, or if you're absent, come back. And so, There's a perception that with a person that has an Oregon ID card that they are a resident, and that could really mislead some folks into giving them some benefits they may not be entitled to. We've had some comments from Adult and Family Services that somehow this could be misconstrued as Oregon residency, and maybe the person would receive food stamps by mistake or something like that, or some financial assistance. Banks and everything are afraid that people would use the Oregon ID card, come in from out of state, not really ever intending to stay here or be here, but use it in order to write some bad checks and things. Now, we did a check on our files to see what it looked like the reduction would be. It's about 4% of all ID cards, and that's where that revenue reduction comes from, is the fees that we collect would no longer be collected because we'd be telling people no. That's about 4%. And so we think it's a good idea to sync up requirements of residency to be on ID cards just like they are for driver's licenses, have the same standard of requirements. So I would ask you to support the bill.
Okay, I'm going to need to ask you this question. I think the answer is apparent, but we have no conflict with any decisions about to be rendered by Attorney General relative to any revenue or dealing with the constitutional requirements of the department.
Mr. Chair, the concern on ID cards is that the fee cover it, and that's addressed in the fee bill from DMV.
Okay. All right. Are there any questions? Is everyone prepared to go ahead and let's do that? I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 317 and open a work session on Senate Bill 317.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 317 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Metzger has moved Senate Bill 317 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further comment? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 317 has been passed and been sent to the floor. Who would like to carry this? Any volunteers?
Oh, I'll be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I make a comment. I was, my staff, you know, as we all do, we clear out our bills.
Right.
And this one was, you know, was inadvertently left in with the current one. And I said, well, gee, this is interesting. Senate Bill 317, it creates a crime of unlawful storage of firearm, punishes by mass. I said, well, we just moved this to the floor. And wrong bill.
Boy, did we get by jury.
Isn't that sneaky, huh?
Make sure you carry the right one.
Hey, now, that would make another signing day.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 432. Patrick, tell us where we are with 432.
Senate Bill 432 authorizes the Oregon Department of Transportation to determine by rule which traffic offenses count toward determining habitual offender status. Oregon statute presently establishes the number and kind of offenses necessary to revoke the driving privileges of a person as a habitual offender. Oregon statute requires that a person's driving privileges shall be revoked if the person commits 3 or more serious traffic offenses or 20 minor offenses during a 5-year period. Proponents of this measure contend that the Oregon Department of Transportation should have more latitude in the determination of the number and kind of minor traffic offenses that result in the revocation of driving privileges of a person as a habitual offender. Further proponents argue that the administrative rule mechanism would allow ODOT to revise the number and kind of minor traffic offenses in a more timely manner based on current information regarding accident rates and driver behavior. No opposition has been brought to the committee's attention. There is a minimal expenditure impact, which means less than $50,000 per biennium that was issued by the Legislative Fiscal Office, and there was a notice of no revenue impact provided by the Legislative Revenue Office. And once again, we have Kelly Taylor of ODOT to testify in favor of Senate Bill 432.
Drop this bill,
the department.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation. And it's true, we requested this bill in order to try to improve the effectiveness of the habitual offender program. And I want to stress that the serious traffic offenses, the 3 and 5 year calculation, are the kinds of offenses like driving under the influence, murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide of the vehicle. This bill does not change that portion. Those are still defined in statute, and that is the majority of habitual offender revocations. About 90% are from the 3 and 5 major offenses. This, again, is just the minor convictions, the traffic infractions. We would like the opportunity to keep that in sync with you all as minor convictions are added throughout different bills along the way. It's difficult to try to keep up when the session's going. There have been convictions that have missed that we think should be part of the program, like refusing to obey a flagger in a work area, things like that, some safety-related convictions. So we would use the public rule process, public input, legislative review, to add and delete convictions that are the 20 in 5 year, which again are about 10%, or we do a total of about 1,100 revocations in a year, and so about 110 are based on the 20 in 5. Very, very few, actually. So anyway, we would like the opportunity to keep this program up to date with the decisions and changes you all make each session. I would ask you to support the bill.
Any questions? Kelly, if you keep bringing this by rule, pretty soon you won't need to come and see us any longer.
Mr. Chair, that's not my intention at all. Again, this is one of those programs, just like the one you voted on the other day, where the older driver study said, you know, it's the impairment and driver actions, and you guys need, in some cases, to have a little flexibility to keep up with trends and changes. And so that's what brought this one forward.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to, are there any other further questions? I'm not. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 432 and open a work session on Senate Bill 432.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 432 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Metzger has moved Senate Bill 432 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further comment or debate? If not, let's go ahead and take the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair George.
Aye. Senate Bill 432 has been passed and sent to the floor. Anyone who'd like to carry it?
I'll do so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Kelly. Okay. And we close the work session on Senate Bill 432, and I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. Patrick, tell us where we are with Senate Bill 367.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 367 modifies state payroll direct deposit statute to recognize electronic transfer of funds. ORS 292.042 enables the direct deposit of state employees' payroll checks, but states that the direct deposit shall be accomplished by issuing a single check to the financial institution with instructions for posting to individual bank accounts. It does not provide for electronic banking. At present, 77% of all state employees' pay is deposited through an electronic transfer of funds. Senate Bill 367 modifies ORS 292.042 to recognize the state's use of electronic banking. There is a no revenue impact statement that has been issued by revenue and no fiscal impact from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Great, John. Welcome. And now you're in the portion of our committee known as general government, I take it.
I am, sir. Well, Senator George and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Radford. I'm Administrator of the State Controllers Division. I won't repeat what Mr. Balducci just talked to you about. This is an attempt by our division to bring the statute into conformance with current practice. We've long since given up on the process of sending paper checks to the bank for these expenditures, and we just do this through the electronic mechanism. And I suspect that over the next couple of sessions, you're going to get more and more bills to kind of modernize the language to reflect a general movement to electronic government. So I would urge your passage of this bill.
Are there any questions? Okay. If not, thank you very much, John. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 367, and with that, open the work session on Senate Bill 367.
Chairman, nice to know we're keeping up to date with modern technology. I move Senate Bill 367 to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair Metzger has moved Senate Bill 367 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 367 has been duly passed and will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have anyone who will carry that? If not, I will do it.
Your turn.
All right, my turn. I think that's where we were headed. All right. Great. John, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to close work session on Senate Bill 367 and open up a information hearing on Senate Bill 372.
Senate Bill 372 extends the term of members of Employee Suggestion Awards Commission from 1 year to 3 years. ORS 182-320 authorizes the establishment of an Employee Suggestion Awards Commission consisting of 7 members appointed by the governor. The Employee Suggestion Awards Commission formulates, establishes, and maintains an employee suggestion program to encourage and reward innovative suggestions by state employees that promote effectiveness, efficiency, and economy in the performance of state government. The term of office for members of the Employee Suggestion Awards Commission is presently 1 year. Proponents of Senate Bill 372 contend that the current term lengths for commissioners are too brief and that commissioners barely have enough time to learn how the program functions. In addition, processing appointments on an annual basis generates an unnecessary amount of paperwork. There's been no opposition brought to this committee's attention, and there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. The first testifier is Kay Van Sickle of ODOT Region 1. No? Did she depart? Okay. Well, I think she signed up for another thing then. Kathy Shepard?
Yeah.
Of the Employee Suggestion Awards Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Shepard. I'm the statewide coordinator for the Employee Suggestion Awards Commission. This program exists to recognize and reward state employees for their innovative ideas, encourage more ideas, and to capture and share those ideas with others. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 372, which would increase the term of office for our commission members from 1 to 3 years. It's a very simple bill, as stated, with no fiscal impact. As stated by Mr. Balducci, the current term length of 1 year for our new members just kind of gets them in the swing of things, learning how the program functions and how we work. They're typically reappointed to serve an additional year or for several years. So processing these appointments on an annual basis creates an excessive amount of paperwork each year. This bill would simply more accurately reflect a typical term of office, make our commission's term of office more consistent with other boards and commissions, and reduce the burden of processing these annual reappointments. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I ask for your support in this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You probably stated this, but when did this when was the statute passed? How long has this been in place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clarno, our program has been in existence since 1980, so this is our 20th, we just completed our 20th year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy, we had a presentation earlier. I don't know if you were in the building. We have some people we might recommend to you who might, in fact, be a person who would be worthy of an award for the work that they've been doing. So, yes.
I got a question, Mr. Chair. Fast question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Since you've been, the Employee Suggestion Commission has been around for 20 years, I just kind of wonder if any of them had suggested changing their terms to 3 years as a suggestion until now, or just that's part of the slow learning process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Besker, no, that has not been suggested before.
Okay, I just wanted to get an award.
Well, you can see how the Mayans work up here. I was thinking the same thing. What was that suggested? Okay, any further questions? Okay, I'm going to go. Thank you very much, Kathy. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 372 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 372.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 372 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Misker has moved Senate Bill 372 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion about that bill? And seeing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Aye.
Seeing the next one. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. That's necessary.
Senate Bill 372 has been passed and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'm supposing we're continuing our order of carrying? Yes. All right.
I'd be happy to carry it.
Thank you.
Oh, all right.
Oh, is that not the man out of order? Oh, no, yes. Have Senator Clarno carry.
No,
he's
next.
Oh,
next? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, let's him do it.
This is an agreeable committee.
That's a good idea, in fact. Yes.
Senator Misker will carry the bill.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 372 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 388.
Good suggestion, Captain? Senator Clarno.
Yes. Okay, correct. Okay. All right. We have pending amendments for Senate Bill 388, and so we're going to close the public hearing on that. And with that, we will be adjourned if there's nothing further to come before the committee.
We say there are amendments for 388?
We have requested amendments that have been made to us, so we thought we would...
That's right. Senator Clarno, we had additional information brought to our attention that included notification that amendments are being drafted and that testifiers were planning on coming in following weeks to testify on this bill, and was hoping that we could hold it over for them and those amendments. So.
Okay, with that, we will be adjourned.
Thank you. I've been reminded that it still wants us to go over to the Senate Democratic Caucus for OBC.
Oh.